Hi, this is Elizabeth Lancaster, and I'm here with Johannes Kratz, and we're going to talk about lung cancer. My first question for you, Johannes, is when you're working with an incidentally found lung nodule, what factors influence your decision for continued surveillance versus biopsy versus resection?
Thanks, Elizabeth. Thanks for inviting me to talk about lung cancer. So basically, we look at a couple of different things. Obviously, you want to look at the patient and assess the patient's risk factors for lung cancer. And then there's a couple of different things you see when you're looking at the scan that may influence your decision to think about whether it's malignant, not, whether you should proceed with biopsy or resection versus continued surveillance. So when you're talking about lung cancer, obviously the strongest predictor of lung cancer and the strongest risk factor is smoking, as everybody knows. So smoking history is a big one. How long they've been smoking, a few cigarettes for a few years doesn't really matter. But if they have a 20-pack year of smoking history, then you start to get pretty suspicious that it might be malignant, and you're more likely to intervene. If they're older, so greater than 60 is a pretty strong risk factor. If they have a family history of cancer, especially lung cancer, that raises your suspicion. And then there's some other more minor risk factors that may or may not influence you completely, because they're not such strong risk predictors, but they are present. So if you're a female, you're more likely to have lung cancer. And lastly, if you have a history of COPD, also is a risk factor for having lung cancer. So you sort of assess all these things, and then you come up with a clinical suspicion, whether you're suspicious or, in more proper terms, a pretest probability of that lung nodule being suspicious for cancer. But there's some other things you can look at on the CT scan which also might guide you. So the size of the nodule is important, of course. Nodules that are less than 8 millimeters are less likely to be malignant. In fact, they're usually malignant only about 5% of the time. But really, above 8 millimeters is where you start to get pretty suspicious. So lung nodules that are between 8 and 20 millimeters, or 2 centimeters in size, they actually have a 20% probability of being malignant. And then when you get above 2 centimeters in size, those lung nodules now have a 50 or greater than 50% chance of being malignant. So size is a pretty important one, and that's why the 8 millimeter cutoff is used in a lot of these solitary pulmonary nodule algorithms to help guide intervention versus continued surveillance. So 8 millimeters is really the size criteria you should keep in your head. There's also some other features of those nodules when you look at them on CT scan that may or may not be worrisome. If the nodule is spiculated, of course, everybody knows that's associated with lung cancer. But what you may not know is that actually there's a greater than 90% chance of it being lung cancer if it's spiculated. So that's pretty important. If the nodule is smooth and round in appearance, then it looks like a little disc on the CT scan. Less likely to be lung cancer. In fact, your chances drop to around 20%, so you may be more inclined just to follow that. There's also other things like calcification. So calcifications, the important thing to know about that is that if the calcifications are eccentric, they're very associated with being malignant. However, if you have complete calcification of a nodule or popcorn calcifications, those are likely to be benign, the latter being associated with hamartomas. That's a common step one question, of course. Growth is also very important, and obviously, if a lesion is growing rapidly, you're more concerned that it's malignant. But something else to keep in mind is that if it's growing too rapidly, it's actually more likely to be benign. So if you are increasing over a period of, let's say, several weeks, cancers don't typically do that. So if some nodule is growing, you get a CT scan in 2 or 3 weeks, and it's, doubled in size. Not likely to be cancer. Cancers don't grow that fast. So too rapid of growth actually is more predictive of benign lesions. And lastly, there is this subcategory called ground glass opacities or adenocarcinoma in situ. Those actually grow very slowly. So if you have a subsolid component or ground glass component to the nodule you're following, you actually want to follow those longer because their doubling time and their rates of growth can actually be very slow. So those are nodules you might want to follow for, 3 years or more instead of the recommended 2 years to make sure they're truly stable. So you put all these factors sort of into your brain, and then you figure out, okay, what's my probability of this patient having lung cancer? And obviously, the more the higher your suspicion, the more likely you are to proceed to biopsy or resection versus continued surveillance.
Thanks. That was a really helpful summary. My next question is, in what situations can mediastinoscopy, CT-guided biopsy, or endobronchial ultrasound with biopsy be useful?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's something that we get a lot. So when do you biopsy lung nodules, and how are all these different modalities? Which ones do you choose? So I have to say that CT-guided biopsy is frequently encountered in the clinic, and what you'll most often see as a surgeon is that patients have an incidentally found lung nodule or a screening CT that had a lung nodule, and then they come in with CT-guided biopsies that are either positive or negative. And you'll very rarely find those ordered by surgeons. So they're transthoracic needle biopsies. Obviously, you have to transverse the pleura, and there's a couple problems associated with them. One is that the incidence of pneumothorax is pretty high. And what typically happens is that these patients go in for a lung, a needle biopsy. They get a pneumothorax, interventional places a chest tube, and then calls thoracic surgery, i.e. me, to admit them to the thoracic surgery service, which is always delightful. And the second problem is that they're often non-diagnostic. So the false negative rate of a CT-guided biopsy is fairly high. You know, it's 25% or higher. So if you're suspicious that it's lung cancer, then the question is, how is that, you know, FNA going to help you? If it's positive, you're going to take the nodule out. If it's negative, you're probably still going to take the nodule out because you're highly suspicious it may be lung cancer. You're not willing to bet 25% of the time that you're wrong. And if it's indeterminate, which it also often comes back as, you're still going to take the nodule out. So in all three cases, you know, you're not really that enthusiastic about doing anything different after the procedure than you were before the procedure, and plus the patients, you know, have a finite chance of complications. So lung biopsy, CT-guided, transthoracic FNA, not typically ordered by surgeons. We make a decision and then proceed or not proceed, usually with a surgical biopsy. So in terms of how you assess, you know, other suspicious findings on CT scan and stuff, that's where mediastinoscopy and EBUS may be useful. So they commonly come into the context of lung nodules if you have mediastinal lymph node enlargement that you see on the CT scan with a lung nodule. So actually in those cases, because a mediastinoscopy or an EBUS is less morbid than an open or VATS procedure to take out a lung nodule, you may proceed with those lesser invasive modalities first. Because if you have a positive lung cancer in a mediastinal node, you can almost with very high certainty predict that primary nodule that you saw in the lung is cancer as well, and there's no need to sample it. So you've achieved the same thing with a lesser procedure. So mediastinoscopy we prefer because it's surgical, you get a lot of tissue, you can run tumor markers on it. The limitation of mediastinoscopy is that it only accesses certain lymph node stations, so we can only really get to stations 2, 4, and 7 with any degree of certainty with a mediastinoscopy. EBUS then opens up a lot of different things. You can get all the hilar nodes, so you can get station 10 nodes, 11. Some people are skilled enough to get out to 12 and so forth. So those, you usually try mediastinoscopy, but if the node is in a location where you don't think you can get, that's when we typically refer to an EBUS expert.
Great, thank you. So next week, we're actually going to talk a little bit more about the technical aspects of performing different thoracic operations for lung cancer. But I wanted to get a little bit of an idea of what your thought process is for when you're deciding which operation to offer what patients. So what factors are important for you in deciding what operation you'll do to resect a nodule, whether it's a VATS versus open versus robotic? I'd like to point out that Johannes did the first robotic thoracoscopic surgery today at Parnassus. And then also what affects your decision for doing a wedge versus a lobectomy?
We're pretty much a cash, no cash system where we base all our decisions on the number of G's a patient lays down. You know, those decisions are basically made on a lot of different factors. So obviously you want to keep things as non-invasive as possible, meaning VATS or robotic assisted. And it really depends on your purpose. It's a little bit of an open-ended question. It depends on your purpose of the operation first and foremost. So if you need a diagnosis, you're going to try to do something very limited. If you're pretty sure of your diagnosis, then you may do something more extensive like a lobectomy. If your purpose is just to get like a resection of a Mets or something like that out, then you're going to do a more limited resection. So it depends a little bit of what you're trying to accomplish, but let's say you have a lung nodule that you're not exactly sure whether it's cancer or not, and you're trying to make the diagnosis. So you're not going to order an FNA, you're going to try to make a diagnosis. Then you have some other, you know, things in play, and what's basically determines whether how invasive you need to be and how the extent of your resection is, how accessible is that nodule. So a lot of people don't think about this, especially a lot of medicine docs who refer lung nodules to us, but you know, minimally invasive techniques like VATS and robotic resections are really only amenable to nodules that are close to the surface of the lung. So either ones you can see, or with VATS, ones that you can palpate. Even if the nodule is large and potentially palpable, if it's central, you really can't wedge those lesions out. So you're going to probably proceed with lobectomy. And is that ideal? Probably not. But do we do lobectomies for a diagnosis of a centrally located nodule? Yeah, we have to, because that's usually the safest thing for the patient. And if it turns out to be cancer, you're done anyway. So those are big determinants of whether what approach you're going to use and how extensive resection is going to be. And lastly, you know, Elizabeth just talked about this procedure we did today. We had a high suspicion it was cancer. It was a ground glass opacity. But the last factor that you have to consider is the patient's risk factor. So this patient that we did today had an FEV1 of 47%. And 40% is usually our cutoff for feeling comfortable with doing any major lung resection, even a wedge. So she was pretty close to that cutoff, making us a little nervous. She was older. It was there's some subtleties here, but even though we thought it was cancer, we thought it was a non-aggressive cancer because it was a ground glass opacity. So we elected to proceed with a robotic wedge, which we thought was in her best interest. And we did confirm the diagnosis. It was adenocarcinoma on frozen section. So those are all the different factors that come into play when you're assessing how to get at these lung nodules surgically.
Great. Thank you. My last question, and I know that you have a lot of interest in this, and this is a very up-and-coming topic in lung cancer and in medicine in general, but how are tumor markers guiding lung cancer treatment now, and how do you see this changing in the future?
Yeah, so that's an exciting question, and that's where a lot of research is going, and there is a specific reason. Obviously, all the buzzword in medicine these days, and especially oncology, is personalized medicine, personalized therapy. So the idea that, you know, not every patient has the same disease, but patients have individual diseases. So when you look at oncology as a field, lung cancer actually is leading oncology in terms of targeted therapies, personalized medicine and lung cancer. And it's really the poster child of how a successful targeted therapy program can work. I want to make one important distinction is that there is a difference between predictive and prognostic markers. So predictive markers in any targeted field or personalized medicine field are markers that will predict treatment response to a certain specific type of therapy. So they're basically finding, you know, a lot of them find what drives tumors. So these main either tumor suppressor genes or oncogenes or something that's altered, and they're pathways that lead to oncogenesis. And if you find a driving mutation in those tumors, then you target therapy against that targeted mutation. So the poster child for this is EGFR. So EGFR is a mutation that is found, it's actually one of the most common mutations found in lung cancer. And not every person who has an EGFR mutation is an Asian female, but most Asian females who have lung cancer are non-smokers. Those patients have a high incidence of having EGFR mutations. And what's nice about finding out that a patient has an EGFR mutation is that there is a very effective treatment for it, which is Tarceva. Tarceva has been around for a long time. It's very effective in suppressing EGFR mutations. And oftentimes, that's the one we want to find, because these tumors respond very well, even metastatic disease. Now, the problem is that, of course, tumors are smart, they evolve, there's natural selection, and then they develop other mutations. So now the field has evolved into finding out which driver mutation is driving these lung tumors, so EGFR, KRAS, ALK, etc., and then trying to target a therapy, monitoring the patient for response. If that patient relapses, then you sample the tumor again, and you find out whether they have a different driver mutation. You try to target that one instead. Those are predictive markers on lung cancer, and again, I think lung cancer is sort of leading the field in predictive treatments and personalized treatments for lung cancer. But something else that's also very exciting is prognostic markers. So prognostic markers tell you that regardless of the driving mutation, that doesn't tell you whether that driving mutation is dangerous at all, right? So you know this patient has cancer, and you're personalizing it in terms of applying treatment for that cancer, but what if the lesion's a pretty benign or a low-grade lung cancer? Well, that's great that you're targeting with a driving mutation, but you're still not helping the patient understand, or you're not directing your therapy and understanding how aggressive you should be, wedge resection, lobectomy, pre-op chemotherapy, all these kinds of things, because it doesn't give you any sense of how dangerous that lesion is. All you know is that this mutation is driving this lung cancer. But if it's a, you know, well-developed or well-differentiated adenocarcinoma, so what? So the other whole focus on the field has been on prognostic markers, which give you an indication of how well the patient's going to do after having been diagnosed and perhaps resected with lung cancer. And this is something that our lab, obviously this is something that surgeons are interested in because we're the ones doing the resections. So we want to know how patients will do after they get surgically resected. And the Javelins lab has done a lot of work in this field to basically develop a prognostic panel of genes to predict how well patients are going to do after they get their lung cancer resected, regardless of their driver mutations. So typically, all the tumors that get resected at our institution get sent out to undergo a prognostic test. And that prognostic test basically gives us an indication, especially for early stage cancers, of how patients are going to do after surgical resection. So if you have a high-risk lesion, which is a proxy for tumor aggressiveness, you're going to be a lot more aggressive about giving that patient chemotherapy than a low-risk lesion, which you may leave well enough alone after having resected that lung cancer. So those two components together are very exciting, and they're really allowing us to tailor our therapy in patients with lung cancer.
Thanks, Johannes. That was a really helpful discussion. We'll see you guys all tomorrow at Schechter Conference at 8 o'clock.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thanks.